for the week of September 13th, 2020. This is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 510, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on Twitch, I'm Michael Giltz.
Ah, you finally joined Twitch. That's okay. My youngest daughter, asked to join Discord, and then she started talking to people from all over the world.
Oh, comfortable. I feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, who approved this app for you? And she's loving it, but I'm like, yeah, no.
Well, I'm back on Twitch because Ninja is back on Twitch. That's right. Gamer Tyler Blevins is back on Twitch. About 1,000 years ago, though it's only 13 months, he left Twitch for Mixer.
And which now, was the Microsoft service. And Microsoft did so well with it, they shut it down.
Yeah. And 13 months later, he said, I'm back on Twitch. He had 14 million followers at the time when he left. He was the most followed gamer. He's a big personality. People will probably come right back to him. No ill will. We'll see what happens. But it's big news if you're in the gaming world, that's for sure.
Yeah. I mean, he received a small fortune to move to Mixer, which is why he did it.
We would move to Mixer. Even if it's closed, we'll move to Mixer.
Yes. You give us that much money, I'll move in. You know what? I'll send my youngest daughter with Discord. I'll send her. the funny thing is, so I said, show me what this Discord is. Now, I knew what it was, but I wanted her to show me so I understood
how she was using it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she was in an Animal Crossing server, as she calls it. This one kid, I don't know whether it was a kid or not, this one person user was saying, hey kid, to everybody, by the way, was saying it to everybody, hey kid, you want some weed? And showed the weeds that pop up on Animal Crossing. Mm-hmm. You can pick weeds on Animal Crossing. And
it's always fun that kids start to get those drug references early on. You want to prep them.
Yes, that should be the title of the show. How to give your young kids drug references before the age of 15.
Well, if we're trying to prep them for what's going to happen on this show, what will we tell them?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're happy to talk about movie box office, even if everything we say has a big fat asterisk next to it, because these are strange times. I don't have to tell you that, probably. Mm-hmm. Hopefully soon we'll be able to talk about theater and live concerts too, and by soon we mean by the end of next year. Or the year after. In agency news, CAA has signed a deal with the Writers Guild of America. Wow, did that just happen?
It did.
I literally read the, I did my rehearsal. I read everything and wow, I should really pay attention to my inbox. In any case, in TV, The Hollywood Reporter made an announcement. It's going to spend a lot less time paying attention to overnight ratings. Do people still pay attention to those? I guess they did.
They do.
Since Michael is still, by the way, on season 2 of Better Call Saul, and I'm still catching up with Fuller House. How rude! I'm actually catching up with Full House. We think it's about time, by the way, that, THR doesn't worry about overnight ratings. How many people, by the way, do you think will actually get that joke, that Full House joke that I just threw in there?
I don't know that I did myself.
Oh, the little girl, like Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, or one of those, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know who said it, but somebody on Full House would always say, how rude.
Oh, no, I didn't get it at all. I've never watched a minute.
Well, okay. So as usual, on Onside Baseball, we'll take a closer look at Oscar's new diversity rules, which everybody was talking about. It was all the rage last week. Spoiler alert, it's nice, but not a big deal. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, speaking of big deals, we'll discuss some of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office, not just the weekends, but the entire week. And he is right now on the phone with Warner Brothers. I see in my, he is
and
on his
Sony.
Knees.
I have Sony on hold.
Okay, yeah, he is. Are you begging yet, or have you offered up small animals? What sacrifice are you making to get these numbers?
Well, they are rough. We're looking at the worldwide box office for the week ending September 13th. It's very catch-as-catch-can. Some movies have definitely fallen through the cracks, like Love You Forever. Is that making any money in China? I have no idea. None of the reports in the trades mentioned it at all. India, there's a blackout on India. I guess their theaters aren't open at all. I don't know. Cosmo Ball, the Russian sci-fi flick, that has fallen through the cracks. So it's really hard to keep track of these movies. I'm not even sure about our number one movie around the world. I think it's The 800. The reporting I saw said its worldwide total is now $389 million. Based on what it made last week, its total then, that means over the past week, it's made $94 million this week. But nobody reported that. I saw what it made in China specifically. Mulan just edged it out. That means it made a lot of money in other territories, or it means the reporting was slack and we were missing some money it was making in other territories. I just don't know what's going on with it. But if it is that $389 million, well, it was just at $280 million and change last week. So that means it has since then made $94 million. We are not confident in that, but we are pretty confident that's the worldwide total right now. We know it made about $31 million in China last week. Did it open up in Korea? Did it open up in other Asian territories? I don't know.
Is this that you're talking about?
The 800.
Oh, the 800. Okay, well, I don't know. But what I can tell you is that this past week, September 7th, through September 13th. Okay, so that's the date range. The 800 made $37.4 million to a cumulative gross in China, by the way. This is just in China, okay? Just in China. $377.7 million in China alone.
Right, that means it made another $22 million in other territories worldwide, okay, since it began, which is very reasonable to believe. I think it's opened up in a few. I think it opened up in the U.S. maybe, but so that's just an extra $22 million. Even if that 377 of its total, that still means it's the number one movie around the world, because it would have made about $70 million last week.
But so, you asked about Love You Forever, okay? So
yeah,
where are you getting this for? You $2.4 million. Oh, in China only. In China only. These are only Chinese numbers.
Right.
And a cumulative gross of $69.8 million. So it has fallen off. Now, mind you, Mulan...
It may not have any charts. It may not have any screens on Love You Forever. So we'll give that in terms of its box office performance. We'll say, well, that may not be its fault. So it's $68.9 million, you said?
Yeah. And I can tell you, just to give you some sense as to what the showings are, we have six... Now, this is for the 800 in China. I'm only talking Chinese numbers here. 609,834, okay, showings, screenings.
Well, you can just round it up or down. We don't need to know every single, yeah.
And 111,000 for Love You Forever. So
right. We don't know whether that's because it did poorly, yeah, or whether it's just not having any opportunities. So that's hard to judge. Mulan, that's in the last week, of course. Mulan, of course, made $32 million over the weekend in China, and it edged out the 800 in the weekend box office total for China. So it did just beat out the 800 for the three-day weekend, but the 800 has been playing all week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. That's why that movie is the champion, because it made lots of money over those first 4 days. That's why we look at the entire week's box office. And why are we focused like a laser on China? Because that's where all the money is being made. There's not a lot going elsewhere. So the 800 is number one around the world. We think it made about $94 million. It made at least 70 plus million, according to Sperling, from China alone. At number two around the world is Tenet. That made $61 million. That's $207 million worldwide. Like we always said, it was going to be a marathon for this movie and any big Hollywood movie, because the North American box office is crippled. It hasn't opened up in China yet, has it? So it's got a lot. That's the biggest market and the most robust one. So Tenet is slowly but surely. It's the tortoise versus the hare. This baby is going to be the tortoise. We'll see where it ends up. But
I still haven't seen it, right? And I know they moved. They opened theaters here in California in Orange County, so it's about an hour away. I could drive to see it, and I probably will at some point.
Well, hopefully it'll open up there before then, but we shall see. And number three,
you know what? What I want to point out is, and this is a Tenet Wonder Woman thing.
That pushed back to December.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, well, you know what? Why don't I save what I'm about to say right now? Because I know we're going to talk about box office collection and how that's being done, correct? Right.
You mean reporting?
Reporting.
All right. So we're looking at the box office around the world. The 800 made about $94 million around the world. Tenet is at number two. It made about $61 million. No surprise, it's not making blockbuster numbers right away, but hey, it passed the $200 million mark. Maybe by December it can be at $600 million. Let's hope so. At number three is Mulan, clouded in controversy. Mulan, the way it's released, how it was released, how it was shot. Oh my gosh, what a nightmare for Disney of their own making. It made $32 million over the weekend. It's at $38 million worldwide in many territories. It's only available as a premium offering on Disney Plus, like here in North America. And number four around the world is After We Collided. This is a real word of mouth smash hit. You probably don't remember After. Then this is the second one, After We Collided. Their movies, young adult romances based on fan fiction written online. They've exploded at the box office. The first one made a ton of money. This one has made $11 million this week. It's at $21 million worldwide and doing great box office. Like in England, in the UK, it was only online for the first movie and everybody said, we want to see it in a theater. So now they've released in a theater and it's making money. The second film, they've already greenlit two more sequels. So there will be four films in this series about what sounds like a toxic man. But anyway, at number five is The New Mutants at $9 million. It's at $29 million total worldwide. At number six is Unhinged, the Russell Crowe flick, another $5 million. That's at $24 million worldwide. And number seven is Love You Forever. That made $2 million, according to Sperling. That's at $69 million, mostly from the Middle Kingdom. At number seven, The Personal History of David Copperfield. That made another $2 million, even though I gave it a bad review. Most people liked it a lot more than I did, most critics. It's at $12 million worldwide. And finally, the Sony Pictures film, The Broken Hearts Gallery. That made about $1 million in its debut. But boy, did we wait a long time to find that out. Sperling?
So, you know what? So, yeah. Like, you want to talk about box office reporting here.
What's been well reported is that Sony and Warner Brothers are holding back their daily box office figures. In fact, even their hourly box office figures. There's sort of a, I don't want to call it a gentleman's agreement because that's sexist. What should we call it? There's just a understanding.
It's an agreement. And it's a contractual understanding through RentTrack that the studio will get hourlies. Now they're paying for this. It's not like they just get it. They're paying for this stuff. And they're paying RentTrack, which is owned by Comscore, to collect all this information and give it back to them.
Right. However, this week, last week, Warner Brothers didn't want to report info. And the RentTrack and Comscore had to get permission from other major studios not to release Warner Brothers daily and hourly box office info.
Until Sunday.
And they all said, well, okay, because we're all trying to put the best face on this and not wanting to let people look at the first hour box office and say, oh, it's a disaster. So they all said, fine, we'll give you a pass this week. But Warner Brothers has continued to do it this week, which is not flying well with all the other studios because that messes up both their ability to analyze the figures and plan the future and see how well things are doing. And should I open this movie in Chicago? How did Tenet do there? Should I open this movie in Cincinnati? You know, they all want answers to these questions and they've always pulled that information. Now to compile the problem, Sony said, well, we're not releasing our info either. It's not clear to me whether RentTrack and Comscore went to the other studios and said, can Sony hide their info?
But that's they did.
Well, nobody's happy about it. And now that's what they're doing. Why? It made $1 million. Who do you think you're fooling? Everybody knows the movie going is deeply constricted in North America. Nobody who matters is going to say, Tenet's a disaster. They're all thrilled. Tenet took a bullet for everybody, is trying to see what can work. That's why Warner Brothers has already moved Wonder Woman because they said, you know what? It's going to take us a long time to make back our money. We don't want another big movie stomping all over it. So we're moving Wonder Woman to December. Everybody wants this info. But as we've seen over the last 4 years, all these sort of understandings, contractual or not, everybody understood this is how we do business. This is the way things are done. Unless you can force them to do it, sometimes they'll just say, no, we're not doing it. And there's not a lot you can do about it.
So, and what's going on here in the U.S., I can speak to.
Isn't it that Warner Brothers wants to put a best face on their money as possible? Well, what else is going on?
Well, okay, so this weekend, first of all, Tenet is doing very well.
No, it's not.
Internationally.
No, it's not.
Here in the U.S., it's made $6.7 million over the past weekend, okay?
And that's not a bad hold. It's like a 20% hold from last weekend, which normally, if you're talking...
In the midst of a pandemic.
Well, but in normal, if you were talking $80 million to $60 million or $55, you go, great. But in this context, when you're making such little money, you would hope it might be more like Titanic and make $10 million a week every week for the next, you know, 3 months. That's what you need. So seeing it drop is actually not good news when there's such pent-up demand.
Well, and part of the issue is that they reported a $20 million box office last weekend. However, that box office...
No, they didn't report it for the weekend. They said the total box office was $20 million. We all understood it didn't make that on the three-day weekend. It made that since it opened up on what, Tuesday? We all know that. This is not a confusion.
No, it had three days of opening. Like Thursday, Friday, the week before, and then...
Right. We all understood it was an extended week, a period of grosses. Everybody knew that. Tenet is not doing well word of mouth. It's gotten poor reviews. It's not getting great word of mouth. It would have probably made a lot of money already if it was a different world and it could have opened up wide and everybody would have rushed to see it opening weekend and second weekend and argue about it. But the fact is, the feedback, the word of mouth, and the box office is not doing great, even in the context of the pandemic. That's okay. We still all are glad it opened up. We still all hope it makes its money back somehow worldwide. But no, it is not doing great at the box office, based on the reviews and the word of mouth from fans, and based on the fact that even with, you know, theaters opening and closing, it's, you know, it made $11 million last weekend. It couldn't make $11 million again this weekend. That's not a good sign.
Well, I can tell you this much. The exhibitors I've spoken with, both overseas and here in the U.S., in North America, there is a huge difference in how they are looking at this film. Overseas in Europe, and in some Asian countries, they're like, wow, we're so happy this actually worked. This was great. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the movie theater operators are very disappointed. And they're like, look, this is going to come off, in normal times, this would have come off this, like in its third week, it would have come off.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, big flashy blockbusters often do better worldwide than at North America. There's more of an acceptance of big flashy movies. If Tenet's doing, it's at $207 million worldwide, just in terms of the business and the health and people not getting sick and going to the movies again and doing it safely, we all hope it can gross $600 million worldwide and be seen as an acceptable hit. You know,
I hope that it plays long enough that when movie theaters in Los Angeles open, I can still see the darn thing, for Pete's sake.
Right, but none of this matters in the context of hiding the facts. Hiding the info does nobody any good. People will always distort and confuse box office figures and yell and scream after the first hour or the first day, but that's no good excuse for hiding it from them or from your other studios.
Well, and as Warner Brothers pointed out, they said, look, we don't owe you these numbers. These are our numbers.
You just said they were contractually obligated to share them. Make up your mind.
They are contractually obligated
eventually?
Yes, to eventually report them, which they do.
Then why did they have to get permission not to report it hourly and daily? You said they had to go to get permission from the other studios, that RentTrak went to them and said, they're going to do this. Is this okay with you? Why did they do that?
But they're contractually obligated to ComScore, not to...
Contractually obligated is contractually obligated.
Also, one of the things that
they are contractually obligated to report that info to ComScore on a timely basis. What do you mean?
ComScore is reporting it to them. Okay, ComScore is reporting it to the studios. However, as part of that contract, they get to say when and to whom that information is given out to. That is part of the contract. So
they always have the right to say, don't tell anybody anything.
Correct.
Warner Brothers can say, do not report a single dollar amount for anything.
With studios, they would probably, that would be not kosher. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's already not kosher not to report hourly and daily figures. That's already not kosher. Don't concede half the battle to them where they say, well, we'll have to report, we can wait. No, it's already wrong of them not to report the daily and hourly figures. That's why everybody confabbed and say, fine, this week we'll let it pass. Now everybody's pissed and they have a right to be pissed because it's been decades of everybody agreeing to share this information, and suddenly Warner Brothers and Sony are reneging on that agreement, and this is going to be the business going forward if they get their way, and they shouldn't get their way.
Well, first of all, it was only in 2004 when hourlies became available.
Fine, and dailies and weeklies before that. It's always right.
And so what? Well, so
people are not in the habit of hiding box office figures.
What is not owed to either movie theater owners or to other studios is your grosses. So if you released a movie, you could say, yes, I will eventually report it.
If you're for a wallet.
Well, no, I'm going to report it weekly. And that's going to be the contract.
They've been doing it for 16 years. They're now reneging on that agreement. Everybody's done it this way. Now, because they don't like the situation, they don't like the numbers that are being reported, they want to back out.
Well, I know this much. Warner Brothers threatened, not threatened, but they basically warned movie theater owners not to be reporting any grosses to anybody but ComScore.
You're such an exhibitor guy. Why aren't you more angry at Warner Brothers? Why are you taking Warner Brothers' side rather than the exhibitors? I don't think they're happy with what's going on.
No, they're not. And that's where I'm headed. I'm trying to be even here. What I will say is that the movie theater owners, normally they get their competitors' grosses. So they know, oh, okay, across town in Cleveland, that theater is doing well. I'm not doing well. What am I doing wrong? Same movie. Same kind of region. What am I doing wrong? Or maybe it's just the people around me, the customers around me don't know that the movie's there. That is one of the biggest issues movie theater operators had with Tenet, is that it was not advertised. It was not marketed, which when I went back and looked, I said, what do you mean? I knew it was coming out. And I thought, well, okay, I'm not the average person.
A lot of digital.
Yeah. Not traditional.
Yeah.
No television, no radio. Very little. And so nobody knew it was even opening.
Well, I don't know anyone who didn't know, but yeah.
Yeah, well, neither did I until I started asking, and people were like, oh, movie theaters are open? And I said, well, no, not here, but did you know Tenet? People
in LA would not be necessarily, because they're not the market for it.
Yeah, so it's just...
Theater owners are upset.
They're upset, and of course they're upset that they can't find out how their competitors are doing, and likewise their competitors can't find out how well they're doing in their market.
And how does Warner Brothers benefit by hiding the numbers? What's the benefit? A few days of people not being sure how well or poorly it's done?
Well, here's what I'm shocked at. If the situation were reversed, if Universal was releasing a movie, right? They would want to know. Warner Brothers would want to know, "Hey, should I release my movie 2, 3, 4 weeks from now? How is Universal doing with that film? We're all in this together." I keep hearing that when I go to the supermarket, over the loudspeaker, they're saying, please wash your hands. Please wear a mask. We're all in this together. Well, the same is true for studios. They're all in it together. They can't talk
to
one
another.
Well, that's not according
to Warner Brothers and Sony.
Yeah.
What benefit has this brought them? None.
Well, they get to control what they think they get to control the news.
They have not controlled the news unless they've tricked you into thinking the movie's doing. No, because you've been speaking to exhibitors and other people. That's how you know what their reaction is to the movie in Europe and other parts of the world. We can see how the movie's doing in North America. People are reporting on the poor reviews. It's this poorest reviewed movie since Tenet. I mean, since Inception. It's more poorly reviewed than that. It's not getting good audience score.
What about Interstellar? You're telling me that didn't get more poor reviews than
maybe it did. Yeah, but he's also not getting good audience scores. So we're reporting on it. We're showing it's having an okay hold from a very limited opening. You might have hoped that there was more of pent-up demand to go see a movie and that the second week it would hold a lot better, frankly. But it hasn't fallen off a cliff, but it's starting at a very low level. And of course, the biggest markets in North America aren't open yet. So maybe in a few weeks, if they do have some limited movie going in New York and LA, there are people who still want to go see Tenet, or will it be tainted goods that people feel like they already know it's not that good? I think it's enough of a spectacle that they probably will show up, and then the word of mouth won't be that great, and it won't do as well as it might have if the movie had delivered. But it's got nothing to do with Warner Brothers hiding facts and figures for a few days from everybody. That does nobody any good. In fact, they shot themselves in the foot when they realized their second weekend was going to look horrible. Lying and hiding is not a good answer to the problem of releasing movies during a pandemic.
Well, first of all, they didn't lie. They
did lie, actually. They released the $20 million figure hoping people would be fooled.
Did the movie make $20 million? Yes, it did.
No, they were trying to trick people into thinking it had a $20 million opening weekend when it hadn't. And everybody had to parse it out. And a lot of regular people. But then they realized the second weekend was going to be $6.7 million. And they went, uh-oh. So yes, they were lying to people. They were misleading them with their facts.
Misleading, yes.
That's a way of lying. That's how you can lie. The line is not simply up versus down.
Well, one of my youngest daughters said, I didn't lie. I just didn't tell the truth.
It's called a sin of omission.
I just avoided that. Yeah, It's called a sin of omission.
If you want to
know.
I
didn't get to see Tenet, but I will when it comes. But you know what I did see over the weekend?
Mulan.
No, I didn't see that. No, much like I go to the Barnes & Noble around me to because I want to support them during this time period, I will go see Tenet no matter what the reviews are because I want to support the film, the filmmaker, and the studio. Now, over the weekend, I saw a movie called I Am Woman.
Oh, you went to a screening or you saw it on a link?
I saw it on a link.
So that's the Helen Reddy biopic. How was it?
You know what? It hits all the notes that you'd expect it to hit. It's
not very good.
Well, it's not that it's bad. That's the thing. It's not bad.
I'm just racked into the fact you're saying, well, it hits all the notes you expect.
Well, because
that sounds like it's not very good. How many stars out of four?
Two and a half. Yes. Right.
So it's
two
not
and a half.
Very good.
My daughters loved it.
Oh, cool.
So it is. And because they didn't know Helen Reddy from, you know, A Hole in the Wall.
Of course
not. But they were like, this is great music. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, why is that man doing so much of that powdery stuff? I'm like, well, that's called cocaine, kids. Don't do that.
More drug references. Your kids are really catching up.
But no, I mean, look, if you look like Helen Reddy, great movie. It's not a bad biopic. It's not. It's, you know, above average.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but
cool.
It's not. Look, I think we all look at biopics now of musicians and look at Bohemian Rhapsody and kind of say, well,
it could be better than that. That's not a good biopic. That's a crappy movie. That's a junk.
Bohemian Rhapsody. There's no pleasing you today.
Bohemian Rhapsody is junk. Mulan, however, has gotten some good reviews. Our friend Stephen Garrett liked it at Book and Film Globe. He gave it a very positive review, but boy, has it hitting it hard in the face with all the controversy very quickly. We've got a link to a good analysis of how Mulan and the original animated version both flip the history of the epic poem on its head to placate Chinese censors. Problem number one. Problem number two, Mulan filmed in the specific areas of China where that country is committing crimes against humanity. According to many international human rights organizations, they are brutally treating the Uyghur Muslim community. It's nightmarish, horrific levels of mistreatment, forced sterilization, forced abortions. It's children taken away from their parents, people being placed into people's homes to watch over them so that they don't practice their religion. It's scary, scary stuff. And they filmed right there. They have all of China to film in. And they said, well, let's film in that territory too. Most of the live action stuff was done in New Zealand, but they wanted to give an epic, you know, sense of China. And they filmed all over the country. They could have skipped the area where the Uyghurs are being discriminated against.
Well, now as the New York Times
I'm not done talking. Let's not confuse people. Let's just lay it all out, right? So they got, then at the end of the film, they thanked the organizations that are brutally treating the Uyghurs, making clear we shot in this area. And it's like saying, we'd like to thank the people of Auschwitz and Chairman Goebbels for all their help in making our movie. You know, really insanely stupid stuff. They're apologizing for this. They're apologizing for that. The New York Times are saying, well, they did know when they were filming what was going on. So by the time August of 2018, when they started filming, the whole world knew about the horrific treatment of the Muslim people in this area. Furthermore, even if they didn't know, by the time they were editing it, they could have said, take out that 1 minute of footage and just ditch it because we don't want to mention the fact. They could have ended that particular problem by editing out that 1 minute. But they have lots of problems. The fact that they filmed there in the first place is a problem. They may have hid the fact, like Warner Brothers is hiding their grosses. They may have hid the fact that they filmed right there. But that doesn't take place the ethical problem of filming in the country as a whole and placating the government as a whole and flipping the entire story as a whole to placate the Chinese censors in a country treating people that inhumanely. So there's a lot of problems with this movie. Our friend Chris Frenton is quoted in that New York Times story talking about it. He brought 30 senators and Congress people have piled on, sending letters to Disney saying, how dare you, with their anger over this issue, which is frankly hard to swallow, but you know, easy points in an election cycle. Then, if that wasn't bad enough, because people started paying attention to it, the Chinese government told their own media, stop talking about the movie. Don't review it. Don't talk about it. Don't mention it. And so there was sort of a blackout the weekend it was opening up. So of course it opened up to softer numbers. Just a nightmare every possible way. They were told at the last second you have 10 days to get ready to open it. Then the Chinese government puts a clamp down on coverage of the movie. Everything you can imagine went wrong with this movie. All self-inflicted wounds by Disney. But don't worry. Their stock is up because analysts like what they're doing with Disney Plus, where you can see Mulan for $30 right now.
Yeah, well, a couple things. I was going to point out that it was, first of all, let's point out the region you're talking about, Xinjiang, is what we're talking about. And you're right. It was a minute of footage. If they had just cut that minute of footage out.
But shooting in China at all is problematic. I thought they were making the movie in New Zealand. I had no idea they went to China.
Well, they did.
Brutally treating more than a million people committing crimes against humanity. Shooting in Shanghai is objectionable. It makes the problem less in your face, but it's still an ethical dilemma.
Right. And that's the problem with China overall is, okay, if you need that market, you got to go and do things like, I don't know, shoot establishing shots, which is what they were doing. They were shooting like wide shots of mountain ranges and they weren't actually shooting actors.
They crafted the entire film to appeal to the Chinese government in power and the Chinese people.
That's a whole, I mean, there's so much to unpack in everything you said. That is another issue that's a problem. The fact that they're, you know, basically we are censoring ourselves because we are appealing to a Chinese censor.
That's right.
Well, that's effective. But what I loved was that Disney executives hadn't seen the credits. I wanted to say, proving nobody watches the credits. I'm kidding, of course. But like, you know, they don't even watch their own credits. That didn't go through a legal process. Obviously, it did go through a legal process, but that legal process said, okay, yeah, no, that's fine. You're just thanking government organizations. It didn't, they didn't click, kind of go the next step.
The dime didn't drop.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of legal issues, Kevin Spacey is being sued. Star Trek's Anthony Rapp and another unnamed man are suing him now for sexual assaults that took place in the 1980s when they were each 14 years old. So Anthony Rapp had been public, one of the first people to talk about, the first person to talk about Kevin Spacey.
He was the first.
Yeah, so they're very brave and good of him. And now many other people have come forward, and now it's going to head to the courts. So that's good to see. Everybody will have their day in court. Festival update, however, Venice has a winner. Speaking of some good news for China, Nomadland won the top prize. That's an American film. It's directed by Chloe Zhao, who is, of course, of Chinese origin, terrific talent. She did, what was it called? The Mustang? Or what was the other?
The Mustang, I think?
No. What was it? Was it called The Mustang? Oh, I've gotten the wrong movie, anyway. I think. Yes, but she's done a number of really well-reviewed films, and now this film starring Frances McDormand shines a spotlight on people who are sort of semi-homeless. They're just living out of their trailers and going from campground to campground around the country trying to make a life for themselves. It's really happening, based on a nonfiction book. And the film played at Venice and won the top prize. So that's worked well at Venice. And in Toronto, after saying, you don't have to wear a mask during movies, Toronto said, you know what? Actually, you do have to wear a face mask during screenings. We're trying to be a little sensible here.
Well, okay. So Chloe Zhao, she directed The Rider.
The Rider is the movie. Yes, I saw it
and
at the
also,
New York Film Festival.
Yeah, and also Songs My Brother Taught Me, which was made in 2015, which, by the way, is when... that film was made in another, you know, political environment entirely when Mulan was first started being made. That's how difficult it is to deal with China, is that things are so, you know, think about what's going on with TikTok right now.
Well, that's been purchased by Oracle, of course.
Well, not purchased. No.
They're partnering with TikTok. We'll see if that flies with the Trump administration.
Well, here's the thing. Disney is partnered with the Chinese government to the tune of $5.5 billion in Shanghai for Shanghai Disney World or Disneyland or whatever it's called. That's how difficult this is. I would say, why are you forcing a company to basically sell itself off to work in your country? Well, guess what? The Chinese government does that all the time.
Yeah, it's not a good precedent, though. I agree.
Like
what the Trump administration did. That's not how to deal with it.
No, that's horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, so Chloe Zhao was born in Beijing. She's 38 years old, a terrific talent, and she's jumped from these incredibly small indie films to Eternals, a Marvel Cinematic Universal film that's supposed to come out in February, though I'm sure that will be delayed, but she has directed a big, big budget movie. We'll have to see how that works out. But we have found out how the agency news is going. Sperling had a huge shock. He had missed his inbox.
You're going to have to take this one. I don't know what's going on.
CAA has signed a deal with the WGA, the Writers Guild of America. It's basically over. They've signed the same deal as ICM. Truly, it's only a matter of time before William Morris Endeavor signs on too. How could they not? Their only caveat, they signed the same deal that we talked about with ICM. All they said was, we'd like more time to comply with the requirement that we limit ownership in a production company to 20%. They say we are committed to complying to that requirement, but we just want a little extra time so we can unwind ourselves financially without doing too much damage. That's it.
That's fair. That's actually a fair
statement. That's fair, but think how amazing this is. The WGA took on all the agencies attempting to end a massive practice that still makes a lot of money for people and will in the future on shows airing on major networks and elsewhere. There's still a lot of money to be made on the back end. However you slice it up, they took them all on and they won.
This is going to be a great book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, granted, it's a great book for people who are interested in this kind of thing. But still, I mean, people thought they were insane, that they were never going to win this. And they totally won.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about the Writers Guild of America.
Right, and taking on both the massive conflicts of interest that agents have and the deal of packaging. Those two major conflicts, they have really... You dealt a blow against them, and they should be recognized and applauded. Because I think those things were wrong, and I think they were right to take them on. What else are you going to fight for if you're a union instead of making sure your agent works for you and you don't work for them?
Well, here's the thing. You know, so you asked a couple weeks ago, why are all these agents becoming managers? Well, the writing is on the wall, right? Partly about this Writers Guild deal, and in part, managers don't have that conflict. Okay, that's one of the rules they don't have to play by. There are less rules for managers than there are for agents.
There are
different
rules.
Different rules.
Different rules. So your agent is the guy that's supposed to just get 10%. That's how. That's what
and get you a job.
All of your history, right? Now it's like he's like, "Hey, you want to work for me?"
Right.
You know, that's a whole different ballgame. That's not that. It's not like, oh, managers are getting away with everything and agents are being screwed. Agencies are huge. They're bloated. They don't provide personal care anymore unless you're a huge superstar. You get lost in the shuffle. Agents are going to be making less money because of the pandemic and the new world we live in. And because these deals, the packaging deals, which were funneling money into them, are falling apart now. You know, that's going to be maybe the writing's on the wall between this and between streaming. So yeah, there's less of a big pie for agents. There's also too much bloat. That's why people are leaving. Not because managers got it easy.
No, I'm not saying they have it easy.
Former agent.
No, I'm not saying managers have it easy at all. What I'm saying is they have it different.
That's right.
And I'm reminded of that every time I watch the opening credits for Black-ish and I see produced by Helen Sugland, who is the manager of Lawrence Fishburne. Okay, so Lawrence Fishburne is in the show. Helen Sugland is a producer on it. She gets a producing credit and thus a producer fee.
That's right. So she's making good money.
Right. So she's making money not just from representing Lawrence Fishburne on that show.
Now, when you're talking about a show like Black-ish, you want to know what's it doing in the ratings? What's it doing in the overnights? What's it doing plus 3, plus 7, plus 30? All these different numbers. Black-ish has been grossing like 3, 4, 5 million viewers, I think. But that's
grossing? You mean attracting?
Pulling in about 3 to 5 million viewers in the last few seasons. But that's based on, you know, some questionable numbers. You know, it's fallen and it's never been a top 40 show, never been a top 40 hit in overall viewers. It's now barely in the top 100, but that's in a world where there are 500 plus scripted shows. It's gotten great reviews. It's remained popular among a core audience. It's attracted millions of viewers, and there's no doubt it's being watched more and more, you know, on demand, second stream, with streaming and all that sort of world. And it'll be a useful syndicated stripping show. You know, that's the world that Black-ish is working in. And that's why when you talk about how successful is it, looking at the overnights just doesn't matter as much anymore. That's why the Hollywood Reporter put out a story simply saying, look, we're not going to talk about overnight ratings much anymore. Because for TV shows like Black-ish, for most of the shows on TV, those overnight ratings are not only a glimpse at what it might do, they're kind of misleading. Because advertisers pay for plus 3 or plus 7, and the overall viewership grows tremendously plus 7 and even sometimes plus 30. So looking at the overnights, not only does it not give you a complete picture, it gives you a distorted picture. So except for big events and live stuff like the Super Bowl and the Academy Awards or some special event, we're going to de-emphasize our overnight rating coverage. We're also going to start emphasizing much more coverage of plus 3 and plus 7 day numbers, because those are the numbers that advertisers are paying for, and they give a better picture of what kind of audience a TV show is grabbing. And I think it's everybody else should do it too. You say, well, it's no big deal. It's long overdue. But in fact, everybody else still plays that overnight game. And that's just not where the information is. They should pause. They should wait 5 days, 7 days, because those are the numbers that matter. Make your best case.
What do you do when people are watching your show and they weren't even born yet when it first aired? So like my kids who watch Friends. Now I get it. If you're an advertiser in 1997, you don't care who's watching it in 2018. I get it. Especially
if
you're not.
But you do care if you're getting some ads on HBO Max, because they're going to have a level where they have advertising on it. And Friends will eventually be one of those shows, or maybe already is one of those shows that if you don't pay extra, you'll be watching HBO Max and see a few ads. Not anywhere near like you would see on network TV. You'll still get the full episode, not the syndicated shortened version. But there will be like a minute, 2 minutes of ads during Friends that your daughters see, unless you ante up and pay for the full maximum no ad purchase price, right?
Yes, that's called AVOD, or Advertising Supported Video on Demand.
And that's why we care that Nielsen, in other TV news, is now covering streaming. They are releasing the most watched programming on streamers. We covered it last week. They're doing it again this week. This is for the week ending August 16th. So it's almost a full month behind. It takes them a full month to collect that information and share it with us. And looking at those numbers, again, we see some interesting stuff. The Umbrella Academy is still the most popular show on streaming. It's watched 1.81 billion minutes reviewed. What they're measuring here is not how many eyeballs check out the first minute of an episode. They just say how many total minutes of this show was watched last week. And in that metric, The Umbrella Academy had 1.81 billion minutes viewed. That's like 60% of what it did a week before when its new season dropped. So it dropped by 50%. Then there at number two is Shameless, the Showtime series, the American version of the long-running British TV drama. That was watched 977 million minutes reviewed by people in North America. I assume that's not worldwide, but maybe it is. You know, we'll have to get that out. Maybe it is worldwide, actually.
Well, that's my problem with these numbers is how are you collecting this information? Where are you getting this information from? Is Netflix saying, well, we won't tell you how many people watched it, but we will. No, well, they're not doing that.
Well, so how somebody watched the whole season and somebody else watched one episode. But I think it's a good comparison when you're looking at streaming, because they have the whole library there. So that library of TV shows, of Shameless, how popular was it last week? I think measuring it by the minutes is a very good decision. But
fine.
Let's get someone on the air. Let's find out. Let's call them up. Let's get them on the air.
I mean, you standing outside Netflix with, you know,
not Netflix. Other people have tried different ways. So let's find out from Nielsen how they're doing this.
Perfect. I will get on the phone with them right now. Bye. Click.
I'm sure they will jump as soon as we call. So yeah, the funny thing about Shameless is a friend of mine, John, last week he happened to mention, I'm watching this show Shameless. You ever heard of it? I'm like, what made you watch Shameless? The Netflix algorithm recommended it to him, and he jumped on it, and he's enjoying it. And so there you go. When he watches it and he likes it, then the algorithm says, oh, now he's watching the whole series. I'll keep recommending it to other people higher and higher. So the show.
By the way, just not to reverse us. Uh-huh. We talked about TikTok, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's the algorithm that is so concerning to everybody, because that algorithm suggests, hey, you should watch the following TikTok person next, and the this next video, and this next video, and this next video. So what China did was they came along and said, new rule, you can't sell anything to a foreign company that is, and they had a whole list of things. No company can sell. Algorithms was one of them. Ah. So basically, they made it impossible to sell TikTok. That's why there's a partnership. And just to show you how important algorithms are, that's why. Because that Shameless was there in that algorithm, as is The Office, as is things like Grey's Anatomy. And look at how popular those shows have become. So if you want to actually sway people's thinking, the algorithm helps.
Well, that's the algorithm on Facebook and the algorithm on Twitter algorithm on YouTube. Yes, that's proprietary knowledge. That's very, very powerful. That's absolutely true. So it's a big deal. You want to have that proprietary information. And if you're buying a company, that's the thing that you want most of all, because you can maybe use it for other stuff.
That's true. In fact, if that's a big deal, okay. And by the way, I'd like to call out how smoothly you transitioned us into that television story, and how smoothly, I'm going to pat myself on the back to say how smoothly I'm moving us into Big Deal or Big Whoop. And by the way, pointing it out means I didn't actually do it smoothly, FYI.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We kind of got into our first story already, which is that everything old is new again, because if you want really proof of that, just check out the cutting edge moves being made by streamers. Outlets like Hulu and HBO Max and Peacock and Netflix are upending the TV and movie business, right? I mean, we talk about it all the time. Right, yeah. And guess what really has them excited these days? You've already mentioned it, Michael. You've mentioned it.
Adverts,
as they say in the UK. Many services are offering multiple levels of subscriptions. Pay nothing or a little, and you watch a lot of ads. Pay a little more and you watch fewer ads, or pay a whole lot and sometimes you can watch no ads at all. That's the deal at places like Pluto and NBC's Peacock. That's always been on tap at Hulu, and now ads are coming to HBO Max. That's really the big deal in my opinion here. They're going to launch an ad-centric level for their service, and those will mix in a modest number of ads with classic movies from the Turner Classic Movies library and other older programming. Warner Brothers insists current HBO originals will not be ad adjacent, but everyone else expects you'll see them creep in. First, with classic HBO shows like Sex and the City, which kind of makes sense because it is a half hour, you know, kind of show. And then recent seasons of ongoing series and so on. You get the idea. This news item, by the way, on Showbiz Sandbox was brought to you by Vitamin Vegemin, the delicious, nutritious drink supplement. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I think, you know, HBO Max is adding in ads to the mix so that people can access their library at a lower cost level than they might do otherwise, maybe even a free level. Who knows? We shall see, like Peacock does. But I've got a great idea for them. You know, they're figuring out these ideas. They've got these streaming services. Hey, what if we charge money? What if we have new creative and original programming? What if we have ads? I've got an idea. You know, they drop these shows at like midnight, a new season. The whole season drops on like Thursday at midnight or Tuesday at midnight. And, you know, you wake up and you start, oh my God, the new season is out. What if they like debuted a show or a season on like, say, a particular night and time, like Sunday at 8 p.m. Rather than doing that, you get all these people lined up just like they did with that new BTS video. They all, 3 million of them, watched it all at once. Maybe you could get people to gather together to watch the first episode of a new season on like, say, Sunday at 8.
Well, you know what, Mike? I'm going to add to that. I think we've got something here. Just stick with me here. Because I think then the second episode, you should put on Sunday at 8, but not the same Sunday at 8, the next Sunday at 8.
Oh, make them wait.
Yes, make them wait like a week.
So instead of blowing your whole season all at once, you like next week there'll be another episode at the same time?
Same time, same place.
Same bat channel? Same bat channel?
Yes, exactly.
Wow,
this is genius.
We should algorithm the heck out of this. We should copyright
this. Yes, definitely.
This.
Oh my God. We're going to be gazillionaires.
Keep going. Don't tell anybody. Keep going.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Don't. Yeah. Well, you know what? I'm sure that's what, in any case, a new ruling in the courts sets a new standard for copyright cases based on true events. It all revolves around the musical Jersey Boys, kind of like life itself. By the way, Jersey Boys is the story. It's the real story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Way back in 2007, a lawsuit began alleging the show ripped off an unpublished memoir by one of the members. Since the group's life is it's kind of well known, by the way, normally an author would insist they, you know, look, we presented the story in an unusual, unique fashion. You know, think of Rocket Man and how it told Elton John's life story as a musical confession made at a 12-step meeting. I mean, that's kind of unusual. Mm-hmm. But in the case of this unpublished memoir, which I guess the author of Jersey Boys or the person who did the book for Jersey Boys just kind of like, you know,
keep going. Don't worry about
kind
it.
Kind of like thought of, it appeared in their head automatically. The author's estate insisted that it wasn't really all true, that unpublished memoir. Sure, they said it was true, but now they kind of claim it was. It was embellished.
And thus copyrightable.
And now that's a lie, by the way. Okay. The same was done when a journalist sued over a work about Tupac Shakur. They said, sure, I pretended it was true at the time, but now I had, you know, I made it all up. And since I can copyright fictional elements, my case should prevail. Not so fast, said the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. If you claim something is essentially factual, you can't get a do-over and later say some of it was untrue just for copyright protection. It will have to be held up on appeal or cited in other rulings to become precedent. That's what's going to have to happen to this case. But at the moment, it is the law. Big deal or big whoop?
I think this is a big whoop, too. It's just sort of courtroom shenanigans. You know, you basically publish something or deal with something that's factual, and you say, well, that's not all true, and thus I can copyright it. That's just a ridiculous game, and I'm glad the courts called them out on it.
Right, and it's kind of like the Diary of Anne Frank, where they, all of a sudden the father, like, oh, well, I helped with the writing, so now we're going to add my name to it. Another 75 years.
Yeah.
As opposed to it becoming public domain, which is what it should be at this point. They said, no. Now Otto Frank, you know, he's a part of it too. And so, you know, that version is the official version. And yeah, it's kind of a nightmare. Now, speaking of nightmares, you know, if you're ready, are you ready to get back to normal, Michael, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So is everybody, actually. But here's the thing. Don't hold your breath. According to Dr. Anthony Fauci and many other experts in epidemiology, you know, we call them scientists, finding a vaccine is just the start. If we get a vaccine by the end of the year that's backed up by this little thing called science, it likely won't be a magic bullet, just something that helps people avoid the worst of COVID-19, you know, just as the flu shot helps mitigate that annual scourge, the flu. And then, by the way, afterwards, after this vaccine is developed, it will take a year to get a majority of people vaccinated. A year. And then, say in December of 2021, it might be reasonable to go to a crowded movie theater and watch a movie with your mask off, according to Dr. Fauci. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a splash of cold water when you're talking about bringing tourists back to any city that depends on tourists, like the UK depends a lot on tourism. New York City is a huge hub. My hometown of Bermuda, or my home island, you know, a lot of places depend on tourism. That's going to be a struggle. Broadway, yeah. They can't make money on Broadway at 50% capacity for lots of big shows, but not every show in the UK. They are reopening in a few weeks, The Mousetrap, the classic long-running Agatha Christie show, and the concert musical Six, which was just opening up on Broadway. They are reopening up this fall. They're removing rows. They're going to have social distancing. They're going to have limited capacity, and that's because they're less expensive to put on. This has nothing to do with quality, but if you have a one-person show, that's a lot cheaper to do than a big, lavish musical like Hamilton or The Phantom of the Opera. Those shows cost $800,000, $900,000 a week to put on. Something with a much smaller cast or a concert piece like Six, those can be done with far fewer people on stage. It's cheaper to do, and so you have a lower weekly running cost, so maybe you can break even. And in fact, what they're saying is, the producers are saying, look, we're actually not even necessarily going to make money every week or any week opening these shows, but we'd rather be spending that money giving people work that they can do safely and having a little red ink than just paying unemployment and paying the cost of the theater being dark. So they're saying, look, we're not going to be making money a lot, but we can squeeze by and maybe lose a little bit money each week, but at least we'll be open, people will be working, and we'll be working out what can be done safely and how. So this isn't like, oh, everything's okay again. It's just, what can we do right now? What can we do safely? How can we get some people back to work and maybe not lose our shirt? That's how hard it's going to be.
So let me ask you, let's just say you happen to have tickets for, I don't know, The Music Man next year in July, starring Sutton Foster and Hugh Jackman. I'm asking for a friend. I mean, will that still go on?
They will be collector's items someday.
Okay. By the way, if you want to know the reference to that joke, please see almost every single episode since the pandemic has started.
Just give them to me. I will go see the show whenever it opens up. Don't worry about it.
Okay, well, here's the thing. When the trailer for the new film Dune dropped, it was only a matter of minutes before people watched it said, what is that song playing at the end? And 2 minutes after that, a bunch of young people began streaming the classic song Eclipse by Pink Floyd, or better yet, listening to the entire album. It comes from Dark Side of the Moon. And if their parents watched that same trailer, chances are, instead of getting all nostalgic and ordering a new copy of the album on CD, they plunked down for a 180-gram vinyl copy. That's what I did. Yeah. Yes, vinyl sales are surpassing compact discs for the first time in 34 years, since 1990, in fact. That was the last time vinyl sales surpassed CD sales. In the first half of 2020, vinyl sold $232 million worth in the U.S., while CDs sold $130 million worth. And by the way, in 1990, if any music executive had seen those two figures, they would have cried, okay? Because those are like ridiculously low. Anyway, Take Heart compact discs. Vinyl bottomed out at just $14 million in 2005 before finding favor again. So there's still hope. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because it's a cute little detail, but the headline really is the collapse of CDs. It's not vinyl doing great. I mean, it's great that vinyl's selling a couple hundred million dollars copies. That's great. It's a great quality product. Glad to see it. It's a niche item. But really, this is about CDs falling off a cliff. So it's sad to see. But they revealed, in fact, though, nice thing to see, recorded music sales are growing when you include in digital and everything and all that. They increased 5.6%. to $5.65 billion.
But that's actually what it's all, that billion, streaming.
That's streaming and everything. Yeah, it's not just physical product.
Yeah, so streaming is going to, looks like, so it's kind of related. We have a link to it in our show notes, a story from Music Business Worldwide that basically streaming year over year, the first half will grow. It's on track to gain more than $1 billion.
Right. And that's within the pandemic. And as we saw in the early weeks of the pandemic, streaming plays went way down because people were trapped with their families and they were doing things communally rather than listening to music on their headphones. They weren't traveling to work. They didn't have that commute anymore in their car. Right. So there was a real question, what would it be like? So it looks like music is going to be okay for 2020.
Well, I don't listen to any streaming service that has other people on it for fear of, you know, getting...
Oh, no, you got to be
the
safe.
COVID.
You gotta be
the COVID. Safe. Yeah. So if somebody else is streaming a song, I'm like, hey, no, six digital feet.
Well, people are safely playing baseball, just like they are safely streaming. And perhaps it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. What are we going to talk about
this week? This week, I'll tell you this much. Your awards contenders will be far more diverse, according to, well, the Academy. They're trying to make the Best Picture category a diverse category. And what do I mean by that, Michael?
Well, I'll tell you this. It's how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice. How do you win an Oscar? Diversity. They put in new rules that will start, I think, 2 years from now. It's only about
2025. 2024, 25.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah.
They could have done it this year. Truly, if you want to be eligible simply for the Best Picture Award, you can be eligible for every other award, but if you want to be nominated for Best Picture, you'll have to meet at least two of four diversity requirements. They're pretty simple. We'll spell the four out for you very quickly. In the first section, it's about what happens in front of the camera. You got to have a diverse person in a lead or major supporting role, or a good chunk of secondary and minor roles must be diverse, or the subject matter must be diverse. Though, of course, if the subject matter is diverse, I don't see how you couldn't have somebody else be diverse anyway. But that's the first section, what happens in front of the camera. In the second section, it's about what happens behind the camera. You need diverse people in key creative positions or, and they're talking about like two, you know. And so if you've got a makeup and a casting person who is a woman, which is the cases in a lot of movies, you're covered in that category. Or you need diversity in six of the secondary crew roles, or 30% of the entire crew must be diverse. Again, not a high bar. In the third section, it's about the future. This is perhaps the easiest area to qualify in. You must offer paid internships. Everybody should. There should be no unpaid internships ever again. And apprenticeships to diverse people, or at least offer training and work opportunities to diverse groups. And the fourth section is about the corporate office. Back at your studio, whoever's back in the movie, you got to have diversity among senior executives. So women, people of color, LGBTQ+I, you know, you need diversity in the front office at your studio. If your studio is led by a woman or has some top key people who are people of color or women or diverse genders or sexual orientations, you got one or two of those and you offer some paid internships to diverse people, boom, every movie your studio makes will qualify. You can make an all-white movie about all-white straight men doing all-white things, and your movie will qualify. So if you look back and people say, oh my God, no movie's going to qualify. This is such a nightmare. If you go back and look at 1917, they point, what about 1917? What about Castaway? It's just Tom Hanks in a volleyball. Does the volleyball count as diverse? Shut up. All these movies already qualified, as far as I can tell, without even having to be able to have those other two sections where they could have just offered some internships or had people at the studios. And they probably qualified in all four categories. This is not a hard standard. It's nice. It's symbolically good. It's super easy to qualify. You're going to be hard-pressed to find a movie that doesn't qualify. You can fall off a log and qualify for this. But it doesn't mean the hard work is over. It just means these are very simple, easy hurdles to jump over. In fact, there is a lot of work to do. Every year, USC analyzes the top 100 movies and looks at the people in front and behind the cameras. And this year, they have found virtually no progress in diversity.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm glad they're doing it. They could have made the standards a little. I don't really think it's the Academy's job to sort of say, hey, who are you hiring for this role or that role? So I'm glad they made them easy. They're making a nice symbolic gesture. It's pretty easy to qualify. They're showing concern, trying to shine a spotlight.
Maybe at least making people think about it.
Yeah. And if they then, and people will analyze the movies and say, well, do they have a diverse cast? You know, they'll start to look at them and say, areas did they qualify in?
Yeah, you mentioned 1917, right?
Right.
So
mostly men, okay. White men. Though there's a
it's all white soldiers.
It's not white soldiers. No, there's an Indian soldier in one key scene, a supporting actor role. He's on the back of a truck, and there's a woman in one scene that's a key role. I mean, it's supporting roles.
A woman helped write it.
Right.
There was the head of Universal Pictures is Donna Langley.
Right.
So
right. That's a key diverse. And then if you look at the people on the crew, they're not necessarily all men just because the people in front of the camera are. You look at the people who are, you know, makeup, casting, etc. Yeah. You look at all these war movies. Like I looked at Dunkirk, you know, you look at this movie and others. It's very easy to qualify. So maybe it will get people to look at movies more closely and they'll say, well, where do they qualify? In what way? So that's useful. But, you know, it's not hard to do. So anybody yelling and screaming and angry, like, oh, everything, nothing's going to work anymore. You know, Nina Gold did the casting on 1917. The set direction is by Lee Sandales or Sandales. That is a woman as well. The costumes were designed by two people, one man, one woman. The head of makeup is Christine Alsop, or one of the heads of makeup. So
Lee Sandales is a man, by the way, just FYI.
That's what I said. It's a man.
Set decoration.
Yeah, that's a man. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, what I wasn't sure about, I believe Lee Smith, the film editor, is... Oh, that's a man or a woman, you said?
You said that... I don't know whether you said the set decoration was a man. Lee Smith is also a man.
Lee Smith is a man. Lee Sandales, I believe I checked and was right, but they already qualified for...
Jacqueline Duran and Nina Gold, done. you're already done.
A different category.
Oh, okay. Well,
I remember the studio, and then there's the on set and behind the camera. There's all these different areas. But yeah, you can qualify in two areas very, very easily. So you would work hard to find a movie in the last 10 years that didn't qualify. Let's just put it that way, truly. So not hard to do. Nice, nice gesture, but really not a big deal.
Sorry, big deal was our last segment.
Oh, darn it. I should have said diversity isn't dead yet. We'll still keep fighting for it. And that leads us to obituaries.
Yes. Well, that's actually, that would have been a smoother transition, especially if you didn't have to mention transitions like, I don't know, me.
I'll be quick here. Toots Hibbert of Toots and the Maytals, reggae legend. In fact, he's the first guy to record a song with the word reggae in it. He was in the film The Harder They Come, classic movie. And that soundtrack, if you don't own it, listen to it now. Stream it now. It's a classic introduction to reggae music. It'll send you off in 100 directions. But a great guy, and his brand new album just came out like a few days ago to good reviews before he died. So that was cool to see that. Got to Be Tough. It's a solid album. It's not, I have friends who love it. I haven't been crazy about it, but it's a good album. Oscar-winning screenwriter Ronald Harwood. He died at 85. He died of natural causes, happily enough. We're not sure about Toots Hibbert yet, but he started in theater and never lost his love for it. He was Oscar nominated for The Dresser and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, and he won it for The Pianist. But he was a playwright, a novelist, a screenwriter. He did film and TV work, and he's the cousin to actor Anthony Schur, who I have interviewed and is a great talent. So is cinematographer Peter Sova. He died at 75. The Czech-born cinematographer, he emigrated to the U.S., hoping to go to film school. Instead, he was repairing movie cameras. So close, but he kept fighting, and soon he was working with film cameras instead of working on them. And he had long relationships with a lot of directors like Paul McGuigan. Am I saying that name right? The director of Gangster Number One. He also,
I believe so,
shot Donnie Brasco and the early best work of director Barry Levinson, including Diner, Good Morning America, Good Morning America, Good Morning Vietnam, and Tin Men, which is a very good movie. But his most enduring legacy, I think, is his work with documentary filmmaker Errol Morris. They worked together on Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, Dr. Death, and the masterpiece that is The Thin Blue Line. That movie is a landmark documentary film, really radically reshaping people's ideas of what a documentary film can and should do. And boy, did it look great.
It did. What's the name of that thing Errol Morris uses, the interview?
I don't know if he did the Interatron, if he invented that.
Interatron, yeah.
I think no, because I think Morris used that long before he worked with Silva. Okay. But here's, you do the next sexy one, because I know she's right up your alley.
Who, Diana Rigg?
Yeah. What a great broad. No?
Yeah, she was a sex symbol. She's won Tony, she's won Emmys. I think she's probably most remembered, given the pictures that were in all the newspapers and all the news stories about this. She was playing Emma Peel in The Avengers. Like, literally, that was all the pictures. And I thought, wait, was there no picture of her from, I don't know, Game of Thrones?
Right. I mean, two Bond girls came from that TV show. First, Honor Blackman, and then Diana Rigg. Right from the Avengers to James Bond. But she did a lifetime of work after that in TV, theater, and film. She was the Bond girl in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, acclaimed stage performances in Medea, which I saw. That was tremendous. And a late life flowering in TV's Game of Thrones and a Broadway revival of My Fair Lady at Lincoln Center. Plus, you knew she was just a fun gal. You could have had a drink with her. She probably cursed like a sailor. Critic John Simon, the late critic John Simon, negatively reviewed her breasts when she appeared naked on stage, which shows how out of touch he is with reality. And
this next person, is that where you were headed?
No, it wasn't. But I should point out that she didn't just play a Bond girl. She played Mrs. Bond, because she married James Bond in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I don't agree, but many do. Bond cultists think it's the best James Bond film. And just recently, I just reviewed a movie she appeared in, Evil Under the Sun, a little appreciated Agatha Christie film, which is great fun. She's in it along with Maggie Smith and a million other people, but that's a sweet little movie if you want to catch it.
Well, and the next person we're going to talk about, they will definitely be celebrating the life of this cool cat. How was that? How was that?
Oh, that was great. Ronald Bell of Cool and the Gang died at 68. He co-founded Cool and the Gang. He co-wrote their biggest hit, Celebration. Enough said. In fact, however, he co-wrote, arranged, and produced and or sang on a lot of their biggest hits, including Cherish, Ladies Night, and of course, Celebration, which was so ubiquitous. It was tied into the 1980 World Series, the 1981 Super Bowl, the 1981 NBA Finals, and the release of U.S. Hostages from Iran. That
wow
is a hit.
Yeah, this guy has been at all of your weddings.
That's right.
All your weddings and bar mitzvahs. Okay,
we
well that yes we yeah. can
all you have to do is bat mitzvahs and bar mitzvahs.
We're available for weddings, bar mitzvahs, heck, you name the event and we will be there. Just write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Of course, you can subscribe to us. You will never miss an episode. We're on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's called Celebrate Good Times Come On.com.
You might want to take the I see. No, because that is part of the song.
No,
that's true.
No, I was just floundering.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to his I don't know, his own website where all of his work is aggregated, michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
There is no dark side of the moon, really. Matter of fact, it's all dark.